listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome, this is Alan Cardoza, and you're listening to Answers for the Family. Today, my co-host is Rob Spencer.
Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Rob. For those that have listened before, you will recognize Rob as having co-hosted before, as well as being a manager of West Shield Adolescent Services. For those that have worked with us, some of your clients that have worked with us, you may have met Rob. He is the one that's out there quite often working with the kids, and getting them to the programs that they need to get to. So welcome. Glad you could be on the show.
Oh, thanks.
And which means you're not on an airplane somewhere.
There you go. Which is good.
Which is very good. Now, our guest today is an author. His name is Samuel Logan. And Sam has written a book that that actually was profiled on a television show as well. And it's called This Is for Mara... I refer to it as MS-13, okay? And I think we'll have him tell us a little bit more about this particular gang. One of the reasons why I've got Rob here is that working with the kids that we work with, many of which are getting involved in gangs. And one of the things that we're hoping to be able to get out of this is some of the ways in which some of us as parents can keep them from being drawn towards this sort of a life. Rob, tell us a little bit about some of the ones that we've transported where gangs were involved.
Well, probably the most common factors are broken homes, are parents that, for whatever reason, maybe it's because they have to pay the bills type thing, but they're just not involved and plugged in with their kids. So they fall into like the peer pressures of what they're craving for family, along with safety for the streets. You know, some of these neighborhoods aren't exactly the nicest suburbs out there.
Sam, are you with us?
Sam, good to be here.
Are you online? You just heard Rob talk a little bit about some of the things that we as parents can do that might keep them from going into that lifestyle.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write this book on such an extremely violent gang.
Well, I think that's a good opening question. The question for me, I think, came about when I started digging a little deeper that I wrote the book about, and I realized that there were so many overlapping groups communicate with one another, and ultimately it resulted in the very tragic ending of this young girl's life that could have been... And I thought that the story of her life had been covered only at the end, you know, when the Washington Post wrote about it a little bit. So I really wanted to get into the story and really stretch it out and develop it as well as I could and explore some of these relationships.
Well, and again, I apologize for those out there as far as a little bit of a technical... problem. Again, Sam, you broke up just a little bit, but I think it cleared up there towards the end. Now, I mean, obviously you got into and looked at a really, really violent and dangerous segment of America.
Right.
How has that affected you?
Right. Well, you know, there are moments when you go to interview some of these guys with the MS-13, the Mara Salvatrucha, and there are moments when, you know, you are a little bit worried about what may come back around. But at the same time, you know, for example, I went to interview one guy in prison in Texas who had killed a number of people but was in prison for having killed one particular person. And the next day I went to talk to his parents, the victim, the guy who was killed. And you know, after an experience like that, when you can look, you know, essentially look death in the eyes, and then next day talk to the people that were most directly affected by that person, you know, I felt like for me that the work is worth it. It was worth the risk that I think I was taking. noting that the more that one learns about the MS-13, or at least in my experience, the more I learn about them, the more I realize that in this country, at least, they're not likely to go after a journalist or anyone of that nature.
Now, why is it growing so rapidly? I mean, you know, this particular gang.
Well, I think the MS-13 is growing particularly rapidly because at the community level, again, you know, this is a story of a lack of communication, and at the community level, there's a lot of communication that doesn't happen. And within families, that can be between parents and children. It can also be between school teachers and parents. It can be between police and parents, or police and members of the community. And that's certainly one reason why it's spreading rapidly, because there's so many young people that are looking at this gang and other gangs as a way to express themselves, as a place to feel, you know, belonging. And they're looking as an alternative to the love and the acceptance they're not finding in their own living room at home from their parents. I think the other reason why it's growing so quickly and expanding rapidly is because it is able to almost perfectly blend within America's Latino communities. And you know, these communities are full of hardworking individuals here, legally and not. But for the most part, these people are not interested in talking to the police. They're interested in working hard and supporting their families and their friends. So where this gang is able to take advantage of that is where the people that they prey upon are reticent to speak to the police and local law enforcement.
So when you find that, when you go into a house to interview somebody and they're not wanting to speak with law enforcement and all that, I know you kind of explain why you think it is because they, basically because they're hardworking and stuff, but what are some of the reasons do you think that they are so hesitant on speaking to law enforcement?
Well, the word deportation comes to mind. And
yes,
and the other part of it is, you know, apart from the very real worry that immigrants in this country have for being mistakenly detained for deportation, because it has happened and you know, the rumors do swirl about on that level. But I think what I found to be a more salient experience and very, very real experience is that for a lot of these people who do come from Latino backgrounds, that either they themselves have lived in a country like Mexico or El Salvador or Guatemala, or their parents have, in the case of younger people, they're raised with a very limited trust and confidence for law enforcement. And I say very limited, conservatively speaking, because in a lot of cases there's absolutely no trust.
Right.
Because if you look at the history of law enforcement in some of these Central American countries, for you, law enforcement is very corrupt and very abusive with their power. Countries in terms of human rights, and so they, you know, they're not a group of men, and so
you know,
feeling in that Sam's emotion and bring it to this country. Yeah,
Sam, excuse me for just a moment. I mean, again, I'm really apologize. We're having a technical difficulty to where things are starting to break up. Could I ask you to call back again, and if possible on another line, because I don't know if it's the connection. I don't know if it's on your end, on our end, but let's give that a try. And maybe if that doesn't, maybe I'll try to call you back. But let me have you call in.
Okay,
first.
I can do that. I'm sorry.
I'll call
right back.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Anyway, Rob, and I know that we've both dealt with quite a few of these kids that are coming out of a gang. I know in one case, from my standpoint, is that from the standpoint of picking them up, one of the issues for us just to leave the house, my belief, based on my belief system, was to save face, that you'll want to walk out of here like a man, where I'm holding you by your elbow or not holding you at all, and we're going to walk out and get in the car. It took me about 90 minutes to figure out that, to me, that's saving face. To him, saving face was, you better put me in handcuffs and take me out of here, because if one of the other gang members sees me walking out of here and I'm not in cuffs, that's the equivalent to not saving face. And that's why I think a lot of parents and a lot of people don't really get it, from the standpoint of what's important to them versus what we think would be important to us.
There is, the bottom line is, gangs exist because for some reason, kids need to feel that they need to fill that void that they're not getting in their home life. That's really what it boils down to. Now, it's a balance of families being broken and spread too thin for their own responsibilities, along with just not working together with communities. So they create these environments where nobody on the right side is to be trusted or believed, and nobody on the left side is to be hung out with. And so now you got this poor kid that's stuck there in the middle, and he's got to pick one way or the other. Now, if I go to the right here and go against the grain of heritage in my own family and that kind of thing, and try to deal with cops or try to deal with teachers and try to deal with leaders and that kind of thing, I get beat up every day. If I go the other way, sure, I might end up in jail, but I got family. I got people. People are there for me. You know, and that's, I mean, oversimplified, obviously, that's the reason. That's it. That's why gangs are there.
Sam, I think you're back with us. Were you able to hear that?
Yes, I was. I hope we've gotten past the difficulties.
I think we have. You're coming in loud and clear. Do you have any comment on that?
Well, I came in on the tail end of that, and I think, Rob, you were describing a sort of a simplified perspective on why gangs exist, where they fill
the
a niche
kids.
Between
yep.
hanging out with the family on one side or hanging out with people in the street on the other.
Well, when I talk about not hanging out with the family, the problem is they don't have family to hang out with. I'm talking about buying into community and buying into teachers and leaders and police and stuff like that versus hanging out with mm-hmm. their friends on the corner.
Well, when you talk about families, it brings to my mind the idea of dysfunctional families created by the necessity of separation for the immigration cycle, where you have kids who watch their father leave to try and go north to find a job in the United States, and they stay home with mom or with their grandparents, or in some cases, you have mom and dad who both leave, and they leave their children with grandparents, only to call them to come north, you know, many years later. And that creates a very difficult environment because there's an estrangement between the children and the parents, especially if when the children arrive, there's another couple of kids involved.
Now, how many out of the amount of gangbangers out there on the day-to-day kind of street level, how many of those cases are there versus where those kids come? This place is falling apart. Where those kids come and on a peer pressure level start influencing now just the kids in the neighborhood. You know, so what I found is the kid that you're talking about comes and he kind of grows up to be the leader more than the follower of these gangs. And he is the guy that recruits and he's already a little hardened. And so he needs to bring up the baby bangers and kind of, they could be anybody. They could be your middle class America kid. They could be because these kids learn how to find what that individual needs and give it to them. At least what they think is that.
Right. Well, I think what you're saying is quite accurate. And in my own research, I found that the kids who are to a dysfunctional family home after having been left in a foreign country for a period of time, those are the guys who oftentimes tend to be the more violent, have the more angst, have the more need to express themselves violently, and tend to be, you know, as you mentioned, the leaders and the ones who are willing to go out and recruit, or, you know, have the right words at the right time to make that recruitment effort really click. But I think it's also worth mentioning that a lot of kids self-recruit. They choose to join a gang, and they may have a friend or a cousin or an older brother even that is a member of a gang, but a lot of times it's that individual, that child, saying, you know what, do I have better to do after school, and wouldn't it be nice for, you know, me to have somewhere to go and feel protected and loved, as opposed to being a turn, you know, latchkey kid and go home to a cold kitchen and, by the way, on the way be harassed by, you know, all kinds of bullies.
Well, now, I noticed, Sam, in your book, it's focused primarily on Brenda Paz's story. One of my questions is, I mean, you know, how does a smart young girl like Brenda get lured into the gang life?
Well, that's a good question. And Brenda, on a level, selected herself. She came from a very well-loved background. I got to know her family in California very well. And just through a twist of fate, she ended up in Texas living with an uncle who had a family of his own and just chose not to give Brenda the love and the support that she needed. Granted, on one level, Brenda was very extroverted and very needy in terms of attention. And when she got to Texas, she didn't have that. But on the other side, you know, if her uncle were to do his job and take her on as an additional daughter, you know, he should have put more time in, I think. So Brenda, after school, mixed up with that street element that so often overlaps with kids after school, and got into a pattern where she started spending more time with that street element, and eventually fell in love with the clique leader of a local MS-13 group. And from there, the rest is history, because he said, look, if you want to stay with me, you have to become a member, because I can't be seen, you know, hanging out with a non-gang member. And that's when she chose to be jumped into the gang.
Okay, explain to our listeners what being jumped in is. And, I mean, and I've read your book now, so, I mean, I understand, and I think I know Rob does, but explain to the listeners what being jumped in and what the other alternative is for a female.
Well, if you choose to be jumped into the MS-13, then that essentially means that you will allow yourself to be submitted to a 13-second beating delivered by five or six or more members of the group of that particular clique. The leader of the clique is the one doing the counting, and so he'll count fairly slowly, as in 1,000, 2,000, or he'll just count with a pause between the numbers. So you take a fairly severe beating, and you're not allowed to defend yourself or fight back. And it's symbolic of the pain and the sacrifice you're willing to make for the gang. And then once the beating is over, you're welcomed into the gang as a brother or a sister or just simply as a homie. The alternative for women is to be sexed in, and that amounts to a gang rape where, you know, five or six guys or maybe more have their way with a female initiate until they've had their satisfaction. And then once that's over, she's considered a member of the gang, but only in a sort of a substandard manner. So Brenda, I think, in part to her relationship with the leader of the gang, and also due to her own strong personality, chose to be jumped in.
Yeah, and that's kind of what my thought was. I mean, as when I was reading it, was that because she was with the leader, she wanted to maintain a certain level of hierarchy, and being jumped in kept her at a higher level. Does that sound right?
Yeah. And also she had a lot of self-respect and a very high self-esteem. She was very smart, very charismatic, and, you know, her personality just wouldn't allow her to go the other way.
Now, you've interviewed everybody involved in this kind of case and that kind of thing, and I don't want to put a bad light on Brenda, but really, do you think she had high self-esteem? Really, do you think she had this integrity and character about herself?
Well, yeah, she did have a high self-esteem in as much as she could, you know, look in the mirror and say, you know, I love you. But there was a certain moment when, you know, a small schism began to form between who she was and who she wanted to be. Yeah. And the wider that schism became, I believe, the harder time she had with looking in the mirror and saying, I love you.
You know, pride
and so her self-esteem definitely dropped.
Okay, pride is, I'm not talking about be proud of what you've done or be proud of your country, that kind of thing, but pride is based on an insecurity, or based on a lot of insecurities, where I think honor is based on character, self-esteem. It's kind of the same byproduct, but they're very driven by different motivations. And do you find that most of the kids that claim all this pride, really, it's driven... their character, their pride in themselves and their self-esteem is really driven based on insecurities, and often it's because of the breakdown of the family?
Well, I think the insecurity has a lot to do with the breakdown of the family. I think the insecurity also has a lot to do with the fact that when they look around themselves, they can't count anyone among their peers as someone who's reliable and supportive. Right. And that, you know, once they get into the gang, those insecurities are redoubled in a sense, because it may feel insecure for not being a productive member of the gang. And I've talked to kids who are former members who said that, you know, they had this real elation, this real rush, you know, for the first week or so, sort of this honeymoon period after having joined the gang. But then they began to feel insecure about the fact that they weren't as hard or as tough as some of the other guys in the gang. And so they wanted to try and get better at that. Mm-hmm. And then once they got to that point, they got to the level where they were asked to do stuff, criminal activity, that again started, you know, creating more insecurities. And because at the end of the day, they weren't bad people. They didn't want to go out and hurt people. They didn't want to go out and kick and punch people and attack people in numbers. So it's just sort of this, you know, never-ending row of insecurity that just keeps piling on itself.
And then
that makes it ultimately very difficult to leave the gang.
And when you put that insecurity in a horrible environment where it's violent and crime-driven, obviously the insecurities will be played out that way.
It's just a real nightmare for these kids.
Sam, one of the things that you brought up in your book, which I really liked, and that is, I like things to where, you know, what can we do about it, or why is this happening to the extent that it is? So it's looking at it from different avenues. And one of the things I know you mentioned is in regards to you know, what's going on in regards to the U.S.-Mexican border. So talk a little bit about that as to how that has kind of helped foster some of the problems.
Well, when you look at the U.S.-Mexico border, it's a very complex situation, and without going into, you know, too many of the intricacies and focusing on the Mara Salvatrucha, you have a very real element of individuals within the MS-13 who are involved in, you know, for lack of a better term here, smuggling. And so when you have kids who are, you know, 12, 13, 14, moving north from El Salvador or Guatemala through Mexico into the U.S., it's very easy for them to get wrapped up in with these guys. And I think into the future it may become even more or even easier for them to get in contact with MS-13 guys, because MS-13 is expanding in this arena of business, of illicit business. So one of the things that, and I was just on the border in March of this year talking to human smugglers on the Mexican side, and one of the things that happens a lot, not just with MS-13 human smugglers, but with a lot of them, is that once they have these individuals at the border, it doesn't matter who they are, where they're from, how old they are, none of that matters, they will levy another tax, let's say, crossing tax, onto the already agreed upon cost of moving them north through the country. And a lot of times the only way for that tax to be paid is through a service. And most often than not, it's criminal service, especially in the case of the MS-13. So there are some cases, I've confirmed at least three cases that I know of off the top of my head right now, of kids, 17, 18, 16, 17, and 18, who once they got to the border in Texas were told, look, in order to move farther, you're going to have to pay us $3,000. Mm-hmm. They didn't have the money. So what they had to start doing was selling drugs in Houston to pay back that cash. And while they're selling drugs and they're on the street, they're engaged in this criminal behavior. They, in most cases, because they need a support system, have no other choice but to join the gang. And then at the end of the day, the gang wins as well, not only because they gain a new recruit, but they gain a layer of insulation between themselves and the police or any sort of law enforcement element out there to try and stop them.
Right, which this ties right into human trafficking, and where a lot of people will think, well, human trafficking has to do with the sex trade. They don't realize that this is a prime example of human trafficking. They are still controlling them either through fear or through financial obligation. It's still a matter of control.
Yeah. It happens a lot, and in terms of the, you know, all of the ideas out there to try and slow down. Human smuggling or slow down immigration from south to north, you know, the bottom line is that it's economics. In Mexico or farther south, you can work 7 days a week, 80 hours a week, and you won't earn as much as you would earn in this country working one full day.
Right.
So, you know, when it comes down to it, it's economics. And these people, you know, and I've talked to a lot of them. I've been off, you know, I used to live in Central America. I've talked to people who were actually deported, you know, within a couple of days of having arrived in the U.S. after a three-week nightmarish trek, And they're ready to do it again. They're ready to do it again because, you know, they look around them and they look around themselves in Guatemala or El Salvador or even southern Mexico or these places. They're extremely poor and there are no jobs for anyone. And they say, you know, I have no other option. My only option is to go north. So the economic incentive is extremely powerful.
Well, in your opinion, I mean, what changes should the Obama administration make to U.S. immigration policy to help alleviate this problem?
Well, I think at a very general level, the people in Washington, not as much, but maybe the people at the state level or at the community level should consider policies of inclusion and not exclusion. And what I mean by that is, before President Obama came into office, there was a very well-defined focus on deporting the Department of Homeland Security, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Bureau was given very specific numbers for the amount of illegal aliens that they had to deport per quarter, and they were told, well, deport as many criminals as you can, but as long as you're meeting your deportation goals, then that's fine. So that was very much exclusion because you're coming into, as a U.S. government, you're coming into these communities and you're targeting people and you're excluding them from the rest of the society, as opposed to inclusion, which would be, for example, in Arlington County, Virginia, the police at one point in time when the MS-13 was becoming a real problem, they decided to install a community policing program, whereby Spanish-speaking law enforcement individuals were able to go into the communities, get to know people, and build that bridge of trust and include them into this society and say, look, we need your help to find the bad guys. Let's get rid of the bad guys, and let's keep the hardworking people, and let's not continue to scare them. So that would be, you know, I'd put more focus on the inclusion part. And then secondly, I think it's worth noting that every month we deport tens of thousands of people from this country back to Mexico, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, just to mention four countries. The capacity that those countries have, especially the Central American countries, the capacity that those countries have to receive that amount of people and process them and then separate the criminals from the real hardened criminals, like members of the MS-13, from other just regular hardworking individuals, you know, down on their luck, is very low. They've asked for help from Interpol, the International Policing Organization out of Europe. They've asked for help from the United States, from the FBI. They're getting a little help, but they don't have enough. And we continue just to shove down their throats, so to speak, tens of thousands of people. And those people are essentially processed by writing down their name and their local version of a Social Security number on a ledger and then pushed on through the door in most cases. And if you're a criminal and you've arrived, and unless you're sort of one of these high-profile guys that comes down on chains, then you just can give them any name and really any number, and then off you go. So El Salvador, for example, has a very serious problem with gangs. It's a national security problem down there, and it has mostly to do with our own deportation policies, which are, you know, obviously very closely linked with our overall immigration strategy.
Well, Sam, I think you are touching on a lot of really good things that I wish we could also get some of our administrators to listen to. We need to take a break, but I want to thank you so much for coming on. Tell us, I mean, I'm sure there are people with more questions. Tell us how they can get the book.
I think the easiest way is to go to Google, put in MS-13 and Samuel Logan. The book's website should pop up.
All right. Well, thank you.
On Amazon.
All right.
That's also an easy way to do it.
All right. I wish we had more time. We'll be back after a short break. And again, I thank you very much, Sam.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Alan.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Rob.
Bye now.
Listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.
All right, we are back, and we're going to have a new guest here momentarily, and we should have him right now. All right.
Yes, hi.
Matthew, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Yes, Matthew, thank you so much for coming on. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Matthew James. He is going to be talking a little bit about NLP. I know that, Matthew, you guys have a seminar coming up that's going to be in Orange County, so I'm going to want you to tell us a little bit about that. But before, tell us a little bit about NLP, Neuro-Linguistic Programming.
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me on the show.
And yeah,
Neuro-Linguistic Programming is a study of excellence in communication, and individuals by the name of Richard Bandler and John Grinder asked a very important question, and that question was, like Virginia Satir, for example, a family counselor who got fabulous results, what made her so wonderful or amazing with her communication, and people who took the exact same classes, learned the exact same things, didn't get the same results? And that is the basis of neuro-linguistic programming.
Well, and now tell us a little bit about about your organization and what you're doing to present the seminars. That's a little bit different. And I don't know if my producer told you, but I mean, I'm trained in NLP, but I was looking at what you're doing, and your HUNA seminars, and it seems like you've taken a very unique approach. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up with these concepts. I grew up with these ideas, and in the 80s, I took my first practitioner training with Anthony Robbins, who back then actually was a teacher on neuro-linguistic programming. I became a master practitioner with Richard Bandler and Wyatt Woodsmall in 86, and when I became a trainer in my 20s, one of the things that I kept encountering was individuals that would come in and they would say, where's the proof? Where is the... How do you know these things are valid? These are great, but... And they would always say, these are wonderful technique, but... And so one of the things that we've really dedicated to here at American Pacific University is in establishing credibility for the things that we teach. We're an accredited university, and we just recently got our NLP online course accredited. So now there is an accredited certification in NLP, which is, I think, the first one on the planet, as best I can tell. So it's really about bringing credibility to these concepts, as well as really giving you not just information, but how do you take this information and put it into action right away?
Well, go ahead. I was going to say we were looking at some of the... I was looking at the website, looking at the seminars that's coming up, and I mean, explain what the difference is based on HUNA. In other words, I mean, what is HUNA? How does that break down and relate to NLP?
Well, HUNA is the modern label for an ancient system of empowerment and flexibility of the mind, body, spirit. And you can kind of think of HUNA as a modern expression of psychology if you added into psychology the concept of collective unconscious, higher consciousness, energy work, and that it's not just about the mind, that it's a true holistic system. That would be HUNA. And the reason why we teach both HUNA and NLP is that those two together create a full study of the three minds. NLP really focuses in on the conscious mind and the unconscious mind. HUNA focuses in on higher consciousness, or what some people call collective, and that relationship to the unconscious mind. So it does create a more holistic approach to studying the three selves that's described by modern psychology and by HUNA.
Okay, now, what would someone like myself need to know in order to study HUNA?
Oh, nothing, just probably a desire. The students that come to our HUNA workshops, they're just usually... I've asked the group quite often, how many of you have no idea why you're here, but you feel a call? And I'll get at least two or three people that will raise their hand, and I go, great, glad you made it. You know, we run our HUNA workshop over here in Kona, and in March it'll be our 20th year doing this, and it'll be our 40th workshop. HUNA, for me, is something that I grew up with similar to NLP, but really much more about a lineage and family-based. The son of the last practicing kahuna in the islands of Hawaii taught all of his family information to my father. He had no one to pass it on to. And then that was in turn taught to me. And I've actually begun to teach this to my son. My son turned 10 this year, and he's begun to learn these concepts. So it's something that has been at least four or five generations now, and in fact, the father of the person who taught my father said, far back as 25 generations. So you're talking about a 28-generation lineage of something that created a lot of peace and harmony here in the islands of Hawaii. It's not the only system that was here, but it was one that really dealt with the mind-body connection.
And now, do they teach this at all at, for instance, at Kamehameha?
At the Kamehameha schools?
Yeah.
I think that there are concepts that are taught across the board in Hawaii. However, Huna specifically, no. I sometimes have people come here to the islands and say, is everyone in Hawaii a kahuna? And that would be the equivalent of going to Vienna and saying everyone must be a psychoanalysis because Freud's from there. Or everyone in Indianapolis must race a car. That's kind of a generalization.
Wait, you mean they don't?
No, they don't. Sorry about that. I don't mean to burst your bubble.
Yeah.
No, I've had some people say to me, I've had some people go, I came to Hawaii and I met a native and he was so spiritual. And I went, yes, that I do believe. Having grown up here in the islands, there are certain concepts that are universal. And, for example, perception is projection. This idea that the world is a reflection of what's going on inside you. My hula teacher, I take hula from Etua, who is one of the kumu hulas at Hulihe'e Palace. He's the only kumu hula actually at either of the palaces. And when he talks about perception as projection, although he doesn't call it that same label. So there were certain concepts that are universal. However, something as specific as huna, that's not taught in the schools. The herbal medicine that was the approach here in the islands called la'au lapa'au, that's not taught in some of the schools. So there are definitely disciplines that are not taught in the schools. However, many of the foundation concepts are.
So your huna is basically your, I want to say, family kind of stuff that you were taught through your family. I know a lot of stuff on the Hawaiian Islands are like that. You know, they're very much about family. Is that kind of the same thing for huna?
I would say that there are certain aspects of huna that were kept within the family, and there are certain aspects that are taught. And so, for example, Papa Bray and his father, Daddy Bray, would teach and would share certain information, just as we do in our workshops. And others were kept within the family. However, many families carried a tradition or a lineage of huna. Some of them called it different labels. Even Papa Bray would say a more accurate label would be ho'omana. Ho'omana means literally means to make energy, but when you put those two words together, it means more about empowerment. And so he would teach ho'omana, empowerment,
now,
to individuals.
Do you, kind of a side question, do you know a guy named David Nueva, who actually passed away not too long ago, but he's big Hawaiian, actually more martial arts than he is on the psychology side of stuff. But, you know, again, it's all kind of in that same higher consciousness energy realm. I don't know is that somebody you're familiar with or anything?
No, okay. No, that's not a name that I'm familiar with. There's at least, I think, close to 1.8 million people that live here now, or is it 1.2?
Yeah. David Nueva is a pretty popular, well-known historic guy. But how, at some point, was it I don't want to say like for lack of a better term, was it, here you go, was it looked down upon to take that off of the Hawaiian Islands, that philosophy and stuff that you have? Because, you know, a lot of that stuff is like, hey, this is our family stuff, and we don't teach it to Westerners.
What do you mean specifically by taking it off the island?
By teaching it to people who aren't Hawaiian, basically.
Oh, you mean when people that are flying in here? Because I teach our Huna workshops in Kona. I live in Kona.
Oh, right. Don't you have one coming up in Newport Beach or something?
Yeah, we have one coming up. Yeah, he has one coming up here as well. Now, I think what Rob is trying to say is that from an ancient time standpoint, was there a time, and we know it's not now, but was there a time in which it was thought to be something that was just part of their family, just a Hawaiian thing that then shouldn't be expanded beyond there?
Well, I mean, when you ask it in that way, I'm going to have to say, of course, yes. There was a time when the missionaries and the Western influence came here, and in fact, that's why we believe it was labeled Huna. The word Huna means secret.
Right.
And so for a while it was Huna, because there were people that literally came here and attempted to wipe out the teachings. So the answer is going to be yes. With regards to sharing it, you know, the kumus that I've studied with, like John Kaimikawa, who's no longer with us, and George Naope, who I just visited in Hilo the other day, the founder of the Merry Monarch Hula Festival, who has dedicated his life to perpetuating these ancient concepts and the Hawaiian culture, he routinely goes to Japan, Canada. He's founded probably a dozen or so hula festivals, and he believes that this is not something that you can buy or sell. It's not something that you can package or put in a box, or even at the end of the workshop, I cannot give someone a title. Like, I knew someone who was running a weekend Become a Kohuna workshop, and there's no way I could ever do that because it doesn't make any sense. What he says, what George Naope says, and what John Kaimikawa said was that everyone has a spirit, and when their spirit is drawn to something like this, it is a part of the culture that you share it. You share your mana'o from your pu'uwai. Your pu'uwai is your heart.
Mm-hmm.
And your mana'o is your thinking. And so they didn't really look at, when it came time to share and the sharing was appropriate, who you were sharing it with was not as important as the reason why. And the reason why is when your spirit resonates with this, when you're called to something like this, then the teachings can begin.
Okay. Now that, yeah, I get that. Now tie this in now with the NLP, because we with what we do with teenagers, we work with teenagers, and the NLP is very, very beneficial as far as us being able to obviously neurolinguistically program them to a desired result. So in other words, if we're dealing with somebody who is having extreme anxiety and they're acting out, and we're going to calm them down. And I think if you can just, I mean, share with the listeners a little bit about things like matching and pacing and how neurolinguistically you can control a situation and hopefully bring either benefit or calm to that situation.
Well, just to clarify something, I have a PhD in psychology, mm-hmm. and I'm very clear. There's no way that I could ever say you can absolutely, with 100% certainty, control a situation.
Well, that's true. Okay.
You can only control yourself in a given situation, and that's truly what NLP is. See,
right.
A lot of the misconceptions about NLP have become because people have studied it, and with all positive intention, I've met some people that have read every book in NLP and are out there already teaching it. And I ask them, who have you studied with?
Mm-hmm.
Who have you trained with? Where is your certification? And it's people that read a book or take a couple courses and then begin to teach these things and these concepts and ideas without having truly delved into it themselves, they may not have that foundation. And the reason why, to me, Huna and NLP fit so well together is because anyone that has taken at least practitioner, master practitioner, possibly trainer's training level, I've asked them a question. How many of you felt that practitioner was fabulous? And everyone raises their hand. Mm-hmm. And how many of you felt like there was a piece missing, but you can't put your finger on it? Every single hand came up.
Absolutely.
And I said, those are some concepts that are taught in Huna. This is the reason why Carl Jung, after doing a thorough study of the unconscious mind, began to delve into collective consciousness. This is why John Grinder, after having studied NLP for so long, went to Africa and modeled tribes and realized that there is a concept called higher self, higher consciousness. Quantum physics has proven that at the deepest level of who we are, there's energy. NLP doesn't talk to either of those two things. NLP is very psychologically based. And so what Huna brings in is that final piece, that part of the puzzle that kind of ties all of these concepts together.
So basically, Huna is a it's more of a self-help tool than it is a tool that you would take and use in a situation like Alan was speaking about, where you would try to, in our environment, control a kid or talk a kid down or you know, get your arms wrapped around a potentially out of control situation.
To me, actually, NLP is much more self-help than Huna. Huna is much more of a spiritual path, I think, for some people, more of a how to become a practitioner working with others in a more holistic model. To me, actually, the foundation level, what you would call practitioner of NLP, is much more self-help. Now, the master practitioner level of NLP is much more of an approach to how do you work with another individual
right.
so that they can become empowered. And so it really, you know, then there's the trainer's level of NLP, which is where you're out there teaching people. So it really depends on the person who is approaching the teachings. And rather than thinking that NLP and Huna are a one-size-fits-all type of approach to working with individuals, you have to realize that after having done this for 20 years, I found people that have come to NLP have no interest in working with other individuals. They only want to work with themselves, and therefore it's self-help. And you have people like Tony Robbins who've taken it and turned it into mass motivation, and mm-hmm. there are people that just want motivation, and that's still NLP. And so it's not any of these things that you're talking about. It's all of them, depending on the person that is experiencing the information.
Right. Now, walk us through a little bit, because again, as we mentioned earlier, we know that you have a seminar coming up here in California, and actually there may be other locations, but we're familiar with the one here. Tell us a little bit about, again, what the date is going to be and how they can get more information about that, but also walk us through, the listeners, walk everybody through a little bit about what they can expect to gain from that.
Well, the workshops that I run on the mainland are going to be more NLP-based. Although I've added in some concepts of Huna, it's going to really be focusing in on how do you learn how to develop a rapport inside yourself so that you are able to consistently produce the results that move you towards happiness. So learning how to be in control of your internal thoughts, your internal feelings, learning how to be a better communicator with someone so that when you're wanting to get a point across, that you're able to get that point across. I think we've all had times in our lives where we felt like we were trying to say something but couldn't get that across. I remember one woman that came to our Atlanta practitioner training, that relationship after relationship, she kept saying, I'm expressing what I want, but they're never hearing me. And after taking the workshop, 7 years later, she's in her marriage, fulfilled, and absolutely in control of her communication. And for me, that's the basis of NLP. How do you become excellent at communication inside and out? And that's what you're going to learn at the practitioner level. And that's the one that we're starting, I think that's on Wednesday. So it's actually probably too late for people to sign up for the one on Wednesday. I think we're already sold out on that one.
Okay.
So I'll be back in California, though, next summer.
Okay. And actually, I wasn't there once? I thought it was, I didn't realize it was starting that quickly.
Now, don't take this the wrong way. I'm not sounding negative about it or anything, but how is Huna different than the other, basically the things that you talk about, even right now in this conversation, are basically the same kinds of things that you would hear if someone were to go to some other type of self-help or spiritual conference somewhere. What's the difference between what you do and what that is?
Well, a couple of key points here. We spend so much time in Western thinking looking at the differences that we miss one of the major points, and that is that pretty much everyone out there that's teaching anything in the realm that I'm teaching, we're all saying the same thing. And in fact, you probably can't say anything new because it's been said for a couple of thousand years now, depending
right.
on what you're talking about. So
exactly.
I do openly admit, of course I'm saying the same thing. I think what makes Huna different, if you do want to see the differences, is that in most native cultures, the information was wiped out anywhere from 750 to 1250 years ago. In some places, you are very fortunate, like in Native American culture, there's only a 400-year gap as to when the practice was really stopped, and the son of a Native Canadian chief on the west coast of Canada came to take all of our Huna workshops, and he said that his tribe had been least affected by Western influence, and yet there had already been a 200 or 300-year gap in the practice. We don't have that here in Hawaii. The people that I studied with, there's a direct link to the ancient practices and the ancient ways. Mike Humuhula Etua Lopez studied with individuals that literally were practicing and maintaining these systems, and it's an unbroken lineage. You don't find that in many other places. You don't find someone that has had this in their family or has a means of saying this is where it goes right back to, and it's unbroken. And so to me, that's one of the things that really makes Huna different or unique.
All right. Well, Matthew, and unfortunately, we have run out of time, but again, can you tell people what is the website they can go to? You're going to be coming on the mainland. Fortunately, this show goes internationally. So where, if somebody wants to get more information about the seminars or when they're going to be, what site can they go to get that information?
Well, they can either go to NLP.com. We are NLP.com, and we also have Huna.com. So you can go to Huna, H-U-N-A.com. And I think both of them link to each other. So if you just remembered one, you'd be able to get to the other one.
That sounds great. Matthew, thank you so much. I wish we had more time, and I hope that we can get you on again and have a little more time and touch on a little bit more of the NLP and some of the applications.
Thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
All right, Matthew. Bye now.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza.
Alan Cardoza.
Only on LA Talk Radio.